All rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you, please, Susan. Good morning to everyone. This is the time and place set for oral argument in Hur versus Hur. You will note that we are missing Justice Flody today. She is excused from this proceeding, but will fully take part in the matter, review the recording of today's hearing, and participate in final consideration of the case. We also welcome to her first argument with the court, and this Justice Colleen Zahn is with the court today. Counsel appearing today for the appellant, John Hur, is Henry Madsen. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
And for the respondent, Mr. Todd Lee. Good morning.
Good morning.
Gentlemen, do either of you have any preliminary matters to take up prior to your argument today?
No, sir.
None on behalf of the
Thank you, Mr. Madsen. How much time have you reserved for rebuttal?
Actually, my opening will be 15 minutes, the remainder from rebuttal.
Thank you for that. With that, you may proceed, sir.
Chief Justice Bevin, Justices, Counsel, may it please the Court. I apologize. I'll try to keep my voice up with these masks. It's kind of hard to speak, and you're in dealing with these oral arguments, your mouth is as dry as it is at any rate, but then add the mask, it gets hard and to speak, so I'll try to make myself clear. I didn't reserve my opening for an extended time because, quite frankly, I don't think this case needs an extended time for oral arguments. In our briefing, we talked about the decision and really what it took at the original trial in this case. And I didn't mean to be flippant in my comments about the nature of the legal issues and the comments that were made. But truly what we're talking about here is a requirement by the magistrate court and then thereafter Judge Gaskell that Mr. Hurley required to retain a professional in order to make his case as to what was included in those accounts after March of 2015 and thereafter when the accounts were split in January of 2016. And those accounts that we were talking about deal with Exhibit D and Exhibit C. First and foremost, account number 178-13821-1 and -2, and account under Exhibit C 178-18020-1 and -0. And I know that Judge Muhlenberg was attempting to address the issue of reasonable particularity and certainty in her decision. And quite frankly, it's not my position that she didn't get it right with regards to the law that she was citing. The issue that Mr. Hur has is that she, in her case, in her decision, she went beyond the standard with regards to the Wild Monster versus Wild Monster conditions of attempting to trace funds after the court has determined that the funds were already, in most part, Mr. Hur's from an inheritance, but then with the gift of the brother, Charles Hur, those funds were included in that joint Tennessee account. And I think it's really important to note that these were joint tenancy accounts with right of survivorship and not community counts. And, and both parties, and the evidence was at trial, that they agreed that this that these counts were not community accounts, and that they were joint tenancy accounts, and that by that, by marking the boxes, and if you've reviewed the exhibits, see the exhibits that set up those accounts that we refer to in our brief, they had boxes that they could mark in making their decision of what type of accounts these were, and they clearly chose that it was joint tenancy. So when any investment that Mrs. Herr made, she would be entitled to that investment, and any investment that Mr. Herr made as a separate investment, separate property, would remain characterized as his separate property if those, for whatever reason, those accounts were split in the future. And
doesn't the fact that the accounts were joint tenancy suggest that they were community?
So, no, it does not.
If Mr. Herr had not put Mrs. Herr on the account, wouldn't that be indicative of his retention of that as separate property?
So what would, and I guess based on, to answer your question, what would be the difference with real property that was held as a joint tenancy? Where you have a partition of two people who own property, they don't even have to be in kinship, and there's a partition and they separate the property. Both parties are entitled to their investments, in particular to whether it was separate property, a community or otherwise.
Well, let me answer your question with a question. If the deed had contained both Mr. and Mrs. Herr on it, are you suggesting that would be indicative of separate property?
Well, ultimately, deeds are held in joint tenancy, and deeds are held as husband and wife, and what I'm referring to as they're apples and oranges. In this situation, you have these accounts that they specifically could have marked a box that said community. They could have marked other boxes, but ultimately they marked the box that said joint tenancy with right of survivorship,
But why was it necessary for Ann's name to appear on the account at all?
Well, and I'm not sure why they put their name on the account, but ultimately, that decision by the court was not appealed by Mrs. Herr. And the decision that the court said that even though that these were joint tenancy accounts with a right of survivorship, she specifically ruled that the money that was in there was from an inheritance, substantially, was from an inheritance that John Herr had received from his mother. And then there was this gift after the fact, after March of 2015, from his brother of the $100,000 that went into the account that was then split into the two accounts. So the judge didn't rule that because that the parties put her name on the account and that they were joint tenancy accounts, that they were just community property. She didn't rule that at all. What she ruled was that John's investment remained his investment, and then there was this gift of $100,000 to the two of them, which would have been $50,000 for both of them. I'm sorry, this hair is back there with this. Which would have meant that they both had, with regards to that gift, an equal share of $50,000 that was included in that. And that's what she ruled, and I know that it seems like the tenor of Mrs. Herr's response brief is that they're trying to somehow suggest that the court made the wrong decision on the joint tenancy accounts, but we're not here on appeal of that. We're here on appeal of what it takes to actually trace those accounts. And the issue is the court, in her decision, the tenor of that decision was that Mr. Herr would have had to have brought an accountant, some professional, to argue what, you know, the tracing of those assets. And that's what we're here on. And so my arguments today is that in terms of reasonable particularity and certainty doesn't require in every case, under Lemonster versus Lemonster, to bring in a professional. If there would be an absurd result if that was the nature of the law, because as we know, family law cases are backed up in the court system, you know, to a month of Sundays. And this case was set for a one-day trial, and in particular, if a party can bring in the account statements and the information necessary to show that the tracing has, with reasonable particularity and certainty, that the tracing has occurred, then that party has made their case.
Counsel, you've been focusing on direct tracing to an expert witness or something along those lines. Is an expert witness necessary under either theory of tracing?
Absolutely not. And that's what I'm trying to say. Lemonster versus Lemonster stands for that proposition.
So in this case, there wasn't a direct tracing. There was you're arguing, I understand your brief, an indirect tracing type of theory, which I like to think of as circumstantial evidence type of tracing. In this case, was the judge expected to do that on her own?
Well,
or did the attorneys present something to her to let her to get her to the point you thought she should have been to?
Well, and we're just asking for this court not to make the decision of really what the nature of these accounts were. We're just asking this court to remand it back for that decision, because ultimately what happened is, Mr. Herr and his counsel relied on statements that were made, and I would point out in the record of the court, page 702, lines 23 through 25, page 703, lines 14 through 25, and line 704, 23 through 25, where the court specifically says, when these documents are being presented to court, and I'm talking about C and D and L, and I believe it was M, where it was all those receipts to support the tracing of what happened to this $100,000 from Charles that went into the house. The court says, well, I always feel obligated and bound to review the exhibits if people go to the trouble to create them. And then she goes on further again, because what happened was counsel was submitting these documents and inquired us to the court of whether he needed to proceed to go further and explain them, and that's when the judge made that comment. And then later on,
haven't we long held that a judge isn't expected to scan the record on behalf of the attorneys looking for evidence to support their theories? Isn't it important for the attorneys to point to the record and say how that evidence supports their theory of the case?
And I agree with that.
Where did that happen here? Where did you point to evidence that would have shown an accounting in your favor?
Well, so ultimately, my position with regards to these statements by the court is that the court cut the attorney off when they were presenting this evidence, making these comments, and then she says, no, it's not a joke. I go through all of these things. I establish that. So if you look at that transcript, in family law cases, a lot of the work is shooting from the hip. You know, you only have a little bit of time to present your case.
There were post-trial briefs submitted by each party. So I understand what you're saying about, you need to think on your feet during trial, but I don't see any discussion of tracing in Mr. Hare's post-trial brief.
Well, if you look at the nature of the case and the way the evidence went in, it was all there, though. One of the things that we're always taught in law school and we're always taught in undergraduate school is the KISS theory. You know, keep it simple. In this situation, it's just a mathematical calculation. It's you have, it was clearly by the evidence, you have $600,000, a little over $600,000 in inheritance that Mr. Herr received from his mother, and then this gift of $100,000 that came out from his brother, which were just really what it was just Edward Jones' accounts being transferred here to here. That's it. No cash involved. That's what it was. And so when we look at the math, I mean, truly, we know that Latin term, ceteris paribus, right? Everything remaining the same. You have $600,000 here, which were considered separate. The judge was correct on that. $100,000 here, which were considered a gift. The court ruled on that. And those monies were made. Nothing else made.
But counsel, when I look at the statements that were admitted as exhibits at trial, those statements reflect that those assets earned income during the time they were in the account. Was there any evidence presented at trial about what happened with the income earned on those assets?
Yes, because all those statements had occurred before trial, and the evidence there as to what was in those accounts at the time of the trial and the tracing was all there. I agree with you that maybe there could have been better argument at the trial, but ultimately, I can't help to say that the court cut that off by saying she was going to do it. And maybe it was a timing thing. Maybe she knew she didn't have enough time to have these arguments to deal with it. But ultimately, she said she was going to go through it, and she was going to make a decision after going through all the exhibits. I see I'm out of time.
Just so I understand, I'm not sure I'm fully aware of the culture of the bar in Northern Idaho, but it's been my experience that attorneys aren't so docile that they are beyond connecting the dots for the judge. I've never seen an attorney, as a judge or as an attorney, that said, "Judge, we trust you to figure this all out. We're not going to tell you how to do it." Are you suggesting that's the culture here, that the judge can just intimidate the attorneys into not arguing the case?
Well, but, ultimately, I wasn't there at the trial. And I would only be speculating about what the attorney did at the trial at that time. And so, but looking in the record and seeing these comments by the judge, it was pretty clear that she wanted to move things along and cut off those arguments. Because Mr. Riedel, at one time, inquired with the court about putting these things in, and she just addressed it in that manner. So, I understand your questions, and that's why I knew you were going to ask about that, and that's why I brought these quotes in from the court, because that's the only reasonable explanation that I have about, the ability to actually sit down and go through all those taxes, right? I mean, all those things. But the judge said she was going to do it. And so, what do you do with that? And I might be able to get a chance to go back in there and show the judge that, look, this is what it is, and truly, I mean, really, at the most, shouldn't she only be getting $50,000 of the $100,000 gift that was initially given? I mean, why are we giving her half of his inheritance, based on that? And we know in Exhibit L these investments were sold, and the money was put in the house. And so not only does she get, a portion of the house that has this money in it that he used from the brother to make the remodel, but she also gets, half of his inheritance. So it's an unfair and it's an unjust decision, and it doesn't require a professional to come in and do it. I know the tenor on my brief was that there was indirect tracing, but there was direct tracing too, because we had Exhibit F that talked about the expenditures. We had C and D, we had A1, we had Exhibit 2, we had R through U, which were all the taxes, and it showed all the statements and what they were worth and everything all the way through that. So it wasn't like the holes weren't plugged with regards to evidence. It was just the timing of being able to be able to argue that, and whether Judge Nuremberg cut him off. And terms of those arguments. And I'm not making excuses here. I'm just trying to point for the record and answer your questions.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Reed, when you're ready, sir.
Mr. Chief Justices, opposing counsel, may it please the court. I would like to present my argument on behalf of my client, Ann Hurd, who I've represented from the beginning when she walked into my office. Before I start, I do want to tell the court that I have over 14 months yet to master the glasses mask anti-fog program. So I'm doing this. I want to apologize in advance. Other people have. I have not.
Some of us feel your pain.
So if you see me staring like this, I will try to move my argument along. This case, it was an interesting case to me because, from my perspective, I made, which I thought was a stellar legal argument to the court, and I'm being very candid, the court said in two sentences, no, but then ruled that these were community accounts or community funds. And so I'll respond a little bit to what Mr. Mattson said regarding and questions to him, if I may. This isn't a case where the court didn't follow direct tracing. This isn't a case where the court didn't follow indirect tracing. This is a case where there was no tracing. Now, I sympathize with Mr. Mattson because I have been in front of this court arguing a case where I was not the trial counsel. And that is not an easy position to be in. You're kind of sitting there in the dark going, okay, well, what happened, what didn't happen? What I can tell the court, having tried the case, is, and I've tried numerous cases in front of Judge Muhlenberg, my experience with North Idaho law, I guess, is, yes, if I'm arguing over a $200 couch, Judge Muhlenberg, just as the rest of the judges I appear in front of, say, great, Mr. Reed, move it on. We got that down. We can argue over whether it's worth $200 or $150, but we're moving. In this case, there was $600,000 in play. Judge Muhlenberg gave us ample time. My experience with judges in North Idaho, magistrates, and I practice in front of numerous of them, just as Mr. Mattson does, is I think they're uniquely placed to understand what's a big issue and what's not a big issue, and they give you time. Their charges started a one-day trial for me 2 weeks ago, and it went 4 days because it was a big issue. So the argument that Judge Muhlenberg cut off Mr. Riedel at the time of trial, it simply didn't happen. The comments that were on the record was the fact that related to, I review all of the evidence that comes in and the exhibits, and what's happened in family law in North Idaho now in the past 4 or 5 years is attorneys are starting to put in 600 pages of text messages between parents that shouldn't be talking that way. So judges are starting to deal with all the exhibits. And that issue came up. And the judge said, I review all of them. But the judge isn't required to review and go search through the fields for this evidence. There was no tracing presented by counsel at trial. The argument counsel at trial made was, and I'll reference it, not the numbers, but Edward Jones 1, that first account that was started in 2011 in Vermont. Edward Jones 1 was funded exclusively with the inheritance from John Herr's mother. We agreed to it. That's a fact. And in fact, that account then received a $100,000 gift from John Herr's brother, and I believe his brother and sister-in-law, it was a joint account they got, that came into John Herr's account and Ann Herr's account as joint tenancy with right of survivorship. Both those accounts were set up that way. Edward Jones 1, Edward Jones 2. And once the judge made a determination based upon the evidence and, as she says, the credibility of the witnesses, as she put in her order, that once that money came in, she determined that to be a community gift, that is a gift to both John and her aunt. And we would, the record's full of the testimony of John, her brother, saying, well, I gave it just to John, and then Ann testifying, I know when the call came in, I know his phone number, I know what he said to me, I know what we talked about, here's what happened. And the judge ultimately, from her ruling, determined Ann Hurst's testimony was more credible, and determined it was a gift to the community. What Judge Muhlenberg did, because it was a complete lack of tracing, said up until that gift came in, that it was all separate property. Now, I can see that. It went against my argument that, hey, Ann testified that she got $243,000 prior to marriage from an injury. They agreed to live on that. And once that money was gone, they would live on this money. And so all that argument that I made about the statements of John Hearn, that's in my brief, his deposition stuff. So I won't go through that. Thank you. But the judge said, okay, up until that time, it was a separate property asset. I think that's the use of discretion. I think that's reasonable, even though I disagree with the ruling, because what she ultimately did prior to that gift was give $180,000, went to the purchase of the home in Priest River area. And she said, no, that's a separate property asset used to purchase a home, so he got that off the top. I think that's following Idaho law if you determine it's a separate property. So, as opposed to, I guess I'm saying this as my argument against opposing counsel, this wasn't a huge windfall for Ann. This is her. The testimony is clear. They spent her money first, and then this money came in. The other issue I want to point out is, and I make that statement because there was a statement to the court that all neither party argued that this was a community account. Edward Jones 1 and Edward Jones 2 were community accounts. We argued all the time that they were a community. The judge ruled against me, but we did argue all the time. We still maintain that. But again, that's not really here nor there, except for I think it does show from the testimony of both parties that these funds were treated as a community funds. We'll live off yours, we'll live off mine. Ultimately, what happened was the judge was faced with a situation where there was a request saying, oh, it's just all separate property. And I mean, and trial counsel, that was their position. And again, it's in the record. Everything that's got in there is a separate property asset. Well, once the judge ruled that that gift that came in of $100,000, his argument failed because he did not do any tricks. He was going, and again, I understand. I mean, I don't know if Mr. Mattson agrees with this, but any given day I make 100 mistakes in court. I mean, you try to do the right thing. It doesn't work out. A witness goes sideways. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just the nature of the beast. But because I believe at trial they were trying to articulate the $100,000 was a separate gift to John Hurd, they didn't do anything. Judge Muhlenberg ruled, hey, I'm judging the credibility of the witnesses. That's a community property gift. And from that point forward, all of that funds were determined to be a community property amount of money. Now, they opened up Edward Jones 2 later on, and those funds came in to Edward Jones 2, half of those funds. But there was no accounting showing, here's how much this generated in income, here's how much this generated in income. And in fact, on page 8 of Judge Muhlenberg's decision, which I think besides, I think page 8 is perhaps the most important portion of her decision because it deals with the Edward Jones account 1 and it deals with the 39 Wesley Lane property. And she specifically states at the bottom of page 8, the respondent has failed to support a request for reimbursement of separate funds for renovation costs due to lack of evidence of which amount the funds were taken. So there were several times that they made this argument, and it was just, when I say they, former counsel, hey, we spent money out of this account to improve 39 Wesley Lane, we should get our money back because it was separate property. But there was never any argument done, never evidence given to say, okay, even if you think this is a gift, Judge, then here's how much it generated, here's the max amount it did, here's the, and there was none of that evidence provided.
Counsel, opposing counsel has basically made the argument the evidence is there, the judge just didn't look at it. How do you respond to that?
And I'll first admit, I don't know the case site, and if I get this wrong, I apologize, but there's my reading of the law, and again, this is just mine, is that we don't set up judges to search for the Easter eggs in the field. We got to bring the basket of Easter eggs to the judge and say, Judge, look at here, look at here, look at here. I think it was interesting that prior counsel in his brief on appeal to Judge Gaskell called Judge Muhlenberg's ruling absurd. And there were some pretty harsh statements about Judge Muhlenberg's ruling here in the briefing. That's interesting to me because that same zealousness of I'm going to represent my client to a point of saying, portraying a judge in unkind words almost. And I don't mean to make too much into this. I don't mean to put too much into this. But why wasn't that a trial to say, here's what this is. And I'll tell you why. Because it wasn't there. They couldn't do it.
So there were no Easter eggs in this case?
None that I've found yet. But again, I'm not bold enough to say there are none. But I will say that my experience, again, North Idaho legal culture is, I come back to the same issue that I think is my lead issue. And again, I apologize. That's why in all these briefings, even though the judge ruled against me, I keep putting it in there on the way out. Now, I get it. It's something that I want to point out that I think the judge, this is the way we could have gone. But I think it's important to note that the judge in this case is being held up to a pretty critical, Judge Greenberg, being held up to a pretty critical eye by Mr. Herr. But I think it's well misplaced. And in fact, the argument of, we just want to go back and try this all over again. I could rattle off 10 cases I wish I could try over because I was not the stellar attorney in them. I mean, I got 2 in the last 4 months. But that's not what we're here for. We're here to give closure to litigants. We're here to say, this is what we had. And more importantly, in this case, this is not what we had. And if we're going to charge judges with the legal concept of the property must be shown with reasonable certainty and particularity, at least bring that evidence to the court. At least say, here's how you track it. You don't need to do it with an accountant. You can do it with yourself. Somebody, Mr. Hurd, could have got up and said, here's how you look at it. That never happened. So we're here asking that the court reaffirm Judge Muhlenberg's decision, reaffirm Judge Gaskell's decision, and find for Ms. Hurd on this particular situation that the judge has got it right. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Madam Clerk, how much time remains for the appellant?
12 minutes, Your Honor.
Mr. Madsen.
Again, thank you for your time. The problem that's in all the previous briefings weren't that Jeff Muhlenberg was absurd. It was that the results that requiring a professional in every case
I don't see that in Judge Muhlenberg's order. I don't see where she says you have to have a professional. So if that's in there, can you direct me to the page where she says that?
So just in looking at the tenor of her decision and having the Easter eggs, as you may, in the basket, sitting there as exhibits, A1, Exhibit 2, Exhibits C, D, Exhibits R through U, Exhibit L, all those exhibits, M, sitting there to say that, and then having the comment saying that she's going to go through those things, and then saying, well, you didn't do anything to trace your, you know, whether what was community or trace, you know, your separate assets in these accounts, that's the tenor of her whole decision.
So you would have to... Counsel, just so I'm clear, so you concede Judge Newland would have never said you have to have an expert to establish tracing?
Well, throughout the post-trial briefs, it wasn't just Judge Muhlenberg's tenor, it was counsel saying that there should have been a professional there, and then having the courts basically affirm the decision based on those briefs.
So I can't say that counsel, Judge Muhlenberg never said that.
I can't point out in anywhere where Judge Muhlenberg said that my client should have retained a CPA to come in and go through all of those. It was simply the tenor of her decision, because there was clearly Easter eggs in the basket sitting there on her desk. But the issue is whether counsel had actually went through each one of those for her. That did not happen. And I can't say that it did not happen because of those comments that were made by the judge that, you know, that she was going to go through all of these things and make a decision. Well, we know that she did not. And I would never say Judge Muhlenberg was absurd at all, and neither would my predecessor. It was only that based on the tenor and based on the evidence and that there was this requirement that potentially a professional had to come through here and make these arguments, that it would lead to an absurd result, just as well as the decision, you know. And I kind of like that scenario that Mr. Reed brought up with regards to the $200 couch, because, you know, we don't require CPAs to come in if we have the evidence and the exhibits that we can show the court that does that tracing. And whether that be indirect evidence or that be direct evidence, in terms of, I mean, what is direct evidence? Is it a CPA coming in and saying, this is his separate, these are his separate assets, this is his separate inheritance? Or is this direct evidence that she has all these tax returns, including the, the form, the forms that show in 2016, form 8949, it shows in 2016 that these investments were sold. And it clearly sets out the investments that were sold that are traced back to the $100,000 worth of investments that were transferred by Charles Hirsch. So,
Counsel, let's go back to your assertion, or your predecessor's assertion, that the result is absurd here. I think you suggested you think this is terribly unjust. Let's assume for a moment I'm willing to wander through the meadow and look for the Easter egg. Why is the result here absurd? What is there that's so inherently unjust about this decision?
Well, nobody is asking the court to wander, not this court either, to wander through a meadow looking for Easter eggs.
But it sounds like that's what we have to do in order to get to the result you want. So give me a reason to want to do that. What is absurd and unjust about this decision?
Well, because the court in the trial specifically stated, you know, to counsel at that time that, look, you know, you don't have to argue these things. You've got them into evidence, and I will go through them.
You're arguing process, counsel. I want to know what about the result in this case is absurd or unjust.
Well, because ultimately, a couple of things. Mr. Reed makes comment that the parties somehow agreed that they were going to live off these inheritance accounts. That's not been the case, and that wasn't the evidence in the testimony. Mr. Hurd specifically testified that his brother gave those investments to him solely, and Charles Hurd specifically stated that I gave those to my brother, but even though Andrew took the stand and said, oh, we had this conversation, and he told me this, Charles Hurd said, I don't remember having that conversation. So therefore, Judge Muhlenberg made the decision that since he couldn't remember about this conversation, that, you know, her testimony was more credible than his. So John Hurd has never been in the position that that $100,000 was gifted to his ex-wife, Ann Hurd.
So the injustice and the absurdity is just that the judge made a credibility ruling that your client didn't like?
No, not at all.
Well, then help me understand. What's the injustice here?
Well, because ultimately the eggs were all there in the basket. And there's specifics. It's not just vagaries with regards to these account statements and these taxes. It's specifics. And when you're in trial and a judge makes a comment, that says, you know, it's no joke, I'm going to go through all this stuff and make my decision based on these exhibits, then when you're at trial and you're the...
I'm going to try a third time, counsel. You keep arguing the process by which the judge reached the result she reached. Let's talk about the result that she reached. Why, if at all, is that result absurd or unjust?
Well, because ultimately Mr. Hur loses a large portion of his inheritance based on the decision, based on the fact that of the tenor of the court's ruling that he was to bring in this professional to to trace these assets through the accounts and ended up with the loss of one half of each account, when in fact it was pretty clear by the evidence. I mean, there were no other investments in those accounts other than these two items. The only withdrawals that were indicated to the court was Exhibit L, and that Mrs. Hur withdrew $5,000 out of the account to pay for her attorney. So really, the tracing was all there. And by not making that decision, that's the injustice. So, I don't know how to answer your question without continuing to go back to those statements from the court, because the result was Judge Muhlenberg did not look at Arthur U, and as she said she was going to, and now we would like to go back, have this court remand the case back, so that Mr. Hurd can go back through there and say, look, here it is, and it's all there. We don't need a CPA, and here are the arguments and the accounting, and get it back in front of the court so that she can make an informed decision. And I agree with all everything that the rulings of the separate versus separate nature of the investments. I just the only thing that we're disagreeing with is the fact that all that evidence was there that specifically showed the tracing, but it wasn't used and wasn't referred to.
Any other questions from the court? Anything further, Vincent?
Nothing further from me.
Thank you. This matter is now under consideration on the screen. Well, if you normally in the good old days, we'd come down and shake your hands. And if you given our circumstances, we'll simply do that from here. Thank you for your time to both counsel and the efforts here. And we appreciate you. Thank you so much.
All rise, please.